This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome Retta Ward. She's Cabinet Secretary for the New Mexico Department of Health. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk about public health in New Mexico, and there's a lot of issues, a lot of things to talk about. But first of all, what is public health? What do we even mean by that term?
So public health is referring to all the activities that have to do with improving the population health status. So we're talking about all the things that contribute to improving health status in New Mexico. So everything from our vaccination programs to our 54 public health offices throughout the state that provide safety net services. So it's a wide range of things that are designed to improve overall health status. And we have a lot of work to do in New Mexico. We rank 37th overall in the country. Not at the bottom of the barrel, but certainly not where we want to be.
Yeah. Now, what's the difference between a public health center and a medical clinic?
That's a great question. You know, health care is very different from public health. Even though our public health offices do provide some clinical services, public health is more oriented toward prevention. So most of the strides in improvements in health status that happened in the 20th century were related to public health initiatives, the control of infectious diseases. And certainly that's a big part of our ongoing infrastructure. We don't want to lose ground in the area of infectious disease. That's why we have such an emphasis on improving our vaccination rates, making sure that adults get flu vaccinations in the fall for the upcoming flu season. But the big improvements in health status going forward are going to be in the control of chronic diseases, the prevention of chronic diseases. Like, for example, in New Mexico, we spend more than $1 billion a year on type 2 diabetes treatment. And type 2 diabetes is almost entirely preventable.
Yeah. We think about, I mean, so many people, when they hear about public health issues, we hear about it in times of crisis, Ebola, Zika virus, things like that. Do we have we had lately crises of that nature here in New Mexico?
Well, we always have to be prepared for crises of that nature. And certainly during the Ebola crisis, we did have a number of travelers that we were monitoring for periods of time. We didn't have any Ebola cases in New Mexico, but that's part of the public health infrastructure that we have to maintain at all times to make sure that we're prepared for a public health emergency. We don't know what emerging diseases might end up on the New Mexico front, but we need to be prepared at all times to deal with those.
Let's talk about some of these other situations, like type 2 diabetes. That used to be called adult onset diabetes, but now so many children are getting it that they changed the name. What's going on?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was a rare thing for a child to have type 2 diabetes. And now it's relatively common because of the increase in obesity rates in children nationwide. But that's one area where we are making progress in New Mexico. So we've had, since 2010, we've had an almost 20% decline in childhood obesity in kindergartners. We measure obesity rates in kindergartners and third graders. There's been a slight decline in the kindergarten obesity rate, but a very significant decline in third graders. And that's really good news, because we know that children who are obese frequently end up being obese as adults. And it's much more difficult to reverse adult obesity than it is childhood obesity.
If a kid is obese when they're 9 years old and you then reverse it through diet and exercise, what are their chances? I mean, what are their struggles? What are their challenges as adults?
So if we get a handle on childhood obesity, then they have a, you know, they have a great chance of having a healthy adulthood. So that's why we have a program called Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities throughout many communities in the state, and it focuses on making healthy choices easy for children and families. So improving the quality of food at school, improving the quality of snacks, improving the opportunities for physical activity. And that involves families, because you really can't address childhood obesity without addressing the family as well. So we're having great success in expanding this program to communities and a number of tribal communities throughout the state as well. And we're very hopeful that we'll continue to have a decline in childhood obesity in New Mexico.
When I was a kid, there were very few obese kids. But when I think about what I ate, I mean, I ate Ritz crackers and Three Musketeers bars and Dr. Pepper and popcorn covered with butter and things like that. I mean, it doesn't seem like it was any healthier diet, and baked beans out of cans and hot dogs. I mean, yeah, there was some salad, there was some spinach, but it wasn't that healthy 20, 30 years ago for so many people. What's changed?
That's a great question, Mary Charlotte. You know, when we go back and we look at the changes that have happened in American lifestyle, we eat much more manufactured food than we did 40, 50 years ago. And we eat many more fast food meals. I don't know how it was when you were growing up, but for my family, if we ate out one time a month, that was a big deal.
That's true.
And
that's
the average family now eats out many times a week, frequently at fast food restaurants, where manufactured food is, you know, what's mainly served. And there, the consumption of sweetened beverages has enormously increased in the past 20, 30 years. So I don't know how often you had soft drinks growing up. But
all the time.
All the time. So you're an exception in terms
not,
of...
Not in our circle. I mean, we would, after school, we would go across the street and buy Starbursts and buy sodas from vending machines.
Wow.
It seemed like everybody did that in
yeah,
the 70s.
Yeah.
Is that not true? I mean, we weren't exactly milking the cow.
Right, right. So, you know, overall, if you look at changes nationwide, we do consume more sugar-added products than we did 20, 30 years ago, more sugar-added beverages, and there aren't as many opportunities for physical activity for kids.
Yeah.
You know, I had free rein of my rural neighborhood, you know, walking the railroad tracks, walking on the country roads, and a lot of people don't live in areas where it's safe to allow their kids to have free rein and go out and get a lot of physical activity in the course of their daily life.
That's what I was kind of getting at, because I suspect that even if you eat a kind of mixed diet, which of course isn't recommended that you have Snickers bars every day, but if you do and you're still running around and playing softball and doing all these things that we all did as kids every day, that probably makes a big difference.
It does, although both are important. And the latest aggregation of research that I've seen shows that diet is more important in controlling obesity than exercise. They're both important, but you cannot exercise away the bad impact of a really poor diet. So they're both important.
So tell us more about the ways in which you're encouraging schools and families to provide healthier diets, and how to what extent that really super healthy food is available to people.
Mm-hmm. So through the Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities program, schools are encouraged to have like fruit and vegetable tastings as snacks for kids. There are opportunities for kids to learn how to shop and prepare healthy foods. You know, it's not enough just to make fruits and vegetables available. If people don't know how to prepare them, they're not going to eat them. So that involves families, because most kids don't do the grocery shopping for themselves. So there are family programs that are associated with this as well. And then getting the community involved in, like, making the community safer for walking. the development of walking school buses where adults walk a group of kids to school and from school so that they have safe transport to school that doesn't involve being in a car, and they get some exercise just from that activity every day.
Now, for the entirety of recorded history, children walk themselves to school. Is that no longer considered safe?
Well, in some communities, it may not be safe. You know, things have changed, and so if parents don't feel comfortable having their kids walk by themselves, they're not going to allow them to walk by themselves.
Yeah.
So the walking school buses are a way to alleviate that fear and to make sure the kids have safe travel to school.
We're talking to Retta Ward of the New Mexico Department of Health. Let's turn to some other issues. I mean, obesity is related to diabetes. When obesity goes down, does diabetes go down in a sort of linear fashion? One follows the other?
They are very much linked. So obesity is the number one risk factor for type 2 diabetes. So decreasing obesity rates will have a corresponding effect on decreasing type 2 diabetes rates as well. So yes.
And what impact does that have on, for example, here we are in the budget session, the New Mexico state healthcare budget?
So, you know, there are lots of costs associated with having any chronic illness, and type 2 diabetes is a chronic illness. We spend more than $1 billion a year in New Mexico to treat type 2 diabetes. So there are huge economic impacts in getting a handle on many of these chronic diseases, and diabetes is one, and diabetes is a risk factor then for many other chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, renal disease, eye disease. It's a risk factor for Alzheimer's. So we have a lot of motivation to decrease both obesity and type 2 diabetes.
And as you said earlier, we are actually on that trajectory, at least in children?
Mm-hmm. We are. So in third graders, we've had almost 20% decrease in obesity rates since 2010, and that's very, very encouraging.
Let's talk also about something else that is a huge problem in New Mexico, and that is substance abuse. There's a lot of substances that are abused. What are the main ones in New Mexico?
So New Mexico has the highest alcohol-related death rate in the country.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm, we do. And we also have one of the highest opiate overdose death rates in the country. So we do have issues with substance misuse. And when you have issues with substance misuse, then you also have really high rates of unintentional injury death rates. So we have a lot of work to do in New Mexico in that area. And that's why substance misuse has been identified as one of the Department of Health's super priorities. We realize that it impacts so many other areas of health. And tobacco is in that area as well. Tobacco use is still the number one preventable cause of death in the United States and in New Mexico. So we need to continue our efforts to, number one, prevent young people from becoming tobacco users and to encourage adults to stop using tobacco because it's the number one cause of preventable death.
How do you do that? I mean, there have been, Lord knows, TV ads since the beginning of time. What kind of education for young people is the most effective?
So there are multiple things. You know, we have a bureau called TUPAC, Tobacco Use Prevention and Cessation, that focuses on using best practices. So getting kids early, helping them understand the impacts, using peer counselors to help them understand the impact of tobacco use, getting kids involved in sports where it's a real negative to use tobacco. So there are lots and lots of activities and strategies that we use. And, you know, the Clean Indoor Air Act has a big impact, too, restricting the places where tobacco is available and usable.
Yeah, I mean, the change in that over the last 25 years has been glorious. You used to not be able to go dancing without turning around and breathing somebody else's cigarette smoke.
Oh, you're right. You used to not be able to fly on an airplane without breathing cigarette smoke. So we are still making progress. We've had an almost 10% decline in the percentage of adults who smoke in New Mexico since 2011. So we are making progress. So we have two things to do. We need to keep helping adults who smoke quit and preventing young people from becoming smokers, because nicotine is extremely addictive. It's much more effective to keep people from ever using it than to get them to quit.
One of the campaigns that I read about somewhere was a campaign engaging young people in a kind of like media literacy, where they start analyzing tobacco advertising, and basically, you know, these kids come to the conclusion that if we buy cigarettes, we're paying these companies to make money, to kill us, and to fool us with their rhetoric about how it looks cool or whatever. And it's a kind of empowerment that's very interesting, because it also encourages a kind of more generalized media literacy.
I think that's a great approach, because you know there is tremendous targeting of ads to young people, even though they can't. The tobacco industry has restrictions on how they can advertise. They're still targeting, because they kill off more than 400,000 of their best customers every year, and they have to replace that customer base. So they're constantly recruiting new customers, and it is helpful to have young people understand that they are being targeted, and that they need to be savvy consumers. They need to be making the choice themselves, not allowing the tobacco industry to influence their decisions.
I suppose the same thing goes for fast food and for cereal and for all those kinds of things that are targeted at kids.
Right. Yeah, there's an enormous amount of money spent by manufactured food to influence people's decision, including children's decisions.
Let's continue with this discussion of substance abuse and opiates in particular. Opiate overdoses and opiate abuse is a huge problem. How much of that is abuse of painkillers, opiate painkillers, and how much of that is heroin?
So we have both going on in New Mexico, but nationwide the bigger killer is prescription opiates. So there are lots of efforts underway, number one, to change the way we look at prescribing opiates, because if we have too many in the system, if somebody needs pain relief for 2 or 3 days, they shouldn't be given a prescription for 60 opiate pills. So part of it is, educating providers about safe prescribing techniques for opiates. It's educating consumers about how addictive these products are and how dangerous they are in terms of potential overdose death. And that's why we have a naloxone program. Naloxone is an opiate antagonist that can reverse the effects of an opiate overdose, and we want to make that widely available so that it reduces the chances that somebody will have an accidental opiate overdose death.
I read the police blotter in the Rio Grande Sun, and there's a lot of opiate overdose and a lot of use of naloxone there, as probably all over the state. But I guess Rio Arriba County is a hot spot for that.
Yes, it is.
So when you talk about education about opiate painkillers, that's one thing. Then what about heroin? I mean, we have a multi-generational heroin use problem in at least certain parts of New Mexico. How do you address that?
That's a really complex issue, and it's very different from the prescription opiate issue. So there's a lot of work going on right now to address, particularly in Rio Arriba County, the multi-generational heroin addiction issues there, and it's going to take the entire community, the entire state. There's not one strategy that's going to work, We need, you know, access to Suboxone treatment for people who want to get off of opiates. We need ongoing counseling. We need jobs so that people have economic opportunities. So there's not a single strategy that's going to work for this, and it's going to take the efforts of everybody involved in this to make progress. There aren't any easy answers for this.
Yeah. What about methamphetamine? That is another thing made famous by Breaking Bad here in New Mexico, but a huge kind of weirdly terrifying, insidious, almost monstrous epidemic in the United States.
And that's another issue, you know, where any illegal drug where there's an enormous amount of money to be made in the sale of it is challenging. It's very challenging. So some of the same strategies, we need to have education, we need to have economic opportunities for young people, and there's not a simple solution to that either, because there's an enormous amount of money in the illegal market.
Yeah. What is the perspective of the health department on medical marijuana? Is that a program that your department administers?
So we do. We have oversight, and we run the medical marijuana program under the Lynn and Aaron Compassionate Use Act. We have approximately 20,000 certified patients who are eligible to use medical marijuana, and we just are in the process of licensing some additional medical marijuana producers in the state as well to meet the demand.
Is there more demand right now than there is supply?
We don't have any concrete evidence today of that. We did a study a couple of years ago that showed that there might be a supply shortage, and so we are committed to making sure that all the patients who need medical marijuana have access to it.
Are you collecting data at all, or do you have any sense of how people are doing with it? I mean, there's so much controversy about it, which I assume will die down over the next couple of decades, because when you look at the changes of marijuana legality 10, 20 years ago and today, it's huge. And if that trend continues, it won't be controversial anymore. But in the meantime, there are real questions because of the lack of research. We only have sort of anecdotal evidence about how people are actually doing. Is it working? Are people happy?
Mm. We don't collect that data either, so we don't have any way of tracking that.
Yeah. Now, another issue, and we're going to stop talking about issues in a moment because there's a lot of other things to talk about, but one more thing that I wanted to ask you about is the issue of teen pregnancy and what the health department's activity and stance, and what are the issues surrounding teen pregnancy in New Mexico?
Well, teen births are a primary driver of generational poverty in New Mexico. And for years, New Mexico has ranked number one in births to girls ages 15 to 19. And I'm really pleased to say that we have moved out of the number one position. The latest data shows that we are now number four, still not where we want to be. But since 2000, we've had a 48% decrease in teen births to 15 to 19-year-olds. That's really significant.
To what do you attribute that?
Well, a number of things. We've had some very aggressive programs to, number one, make birth control widely available to teenagers. Education, we have sexuality education is more widely available in schools than it used to be. And it's part of a nationwide trend. Teen births are declining nationwide. And we want that to continue in New Mexico because we know that health outcomes are poorer for children born to teen mothers. We know that educational attainment is limited. Economic attainment is limited for teen parents. And there's a greater risk of incarceration for teen parents and for children born to teen parents. So there are all kinds of positive outcomes if we can continue to decrease the teen birth rate in New Mexico. So we've identified delaying parenthood as one of our super priorities in the Department of Health. And we want to match that 48% decrease in 14 years. We want to do that in 4 years. We want to have another 50% decline in the teen birth rate in New Mexico. That has huge implications for improving not only health status in New Mexico, but educational status, economic status of young people in New Mexico as well.
Who are your partners in making birth control available to teenagers?
So we have a number of partners throughout the state. We have 54 public health offices throughout the state. We have a number of school-based health centers, many of which provide reproductive health services. So we partner with lots and lots of different entities throughout the state. And, you know, it's become widely known now that LARCs, they're called long-acting reversible contraceptives, their IUDs and implants, are appropriate for teenagers. And so we're encouraging the use of the most effective contraceptives for young teenagers who want to delay parenthood. We want kids, young people, to develop a reproductive life plan, not just allow parenthood to happen to them. So we're encouraging planning for that. You know, when do you, if do you want to have children? When do you want to have children? And if you don't want to become a parent now, then what is your plan to not become a parent right now?
To what extent is it important for this kind of program to be effective for the, for example, the young woman's parents to approve of their getting, say, an IUD?
Well, we still think parents are the best sexuality educators, and we encourage parents to be involved in those decisions. Now, that doesn't always happen, but we have programs available to help parents become more comfortable talking with their kids about sex and sexuality. We have a texting service called Birds and Bees that teens and parents can text their questions about sex, sexuality, reproductive health, and they'll get a medically accurate answer within 24 hours. So we're trying to make it easier for teens and parents to communicate, because parents do want to be involved in helping their children make good life choices, and we're trying to encourage that to happen.
It's funny, it's such a cultural thing. I met somebody who... A young person who had spent like a semester or a year in Holland and wrote a paper about the difference between how parents and children talk to each other about sexuality in Holland versus the United States. And apparently in Holland, at least where this person was, it was a very kind of open and healthy and non-judgmental, I mean, the way you would talk about anything. This is a natural part of life. Here we have the Puritan overlay, we have the Catholic Church, we have fundamentalism, we've got all kinds of things.
And you know, it's interesting because sometimes we think that a one-time talk is all you need with kids.
The talk.
The talk when they're 12, 13, 14, and obviously that's not effective. So you need an ongoing dialogue with your children from the time they're very small, age-appropriate vocabulary, topics, subjects. But that's what's successful. You have to have ongoing dialogue. So even though we have, in some ways, a highly sexualized culture, we sensationalize sexuality in the media, we still are not that comfortable talking about it in a healthy way.
And those two things are probably related.
They probably are related, yes. So the Department of Health is working to help with that, to help parents become more comfortable in having those conversations throughout their children's lives, not just, you know, the pre-puberty kind of one-time talk.
And the integration of sexuality and eros and all those things into daily life as normal things as opposed to dirty things, I think, I mean, one can imagine a kind of healthy future for this country, which would probably have an impact. I mean, I've met young people who, the people who feel like they have the most freedom to not have sex until they really want to, are the people who come from homes with the fewest taboos.
Yeah, an interesting correlation there, isn't it?
Yeah. So, How did you get into this whole field of health and public health?
Well, years ago when I was a student at Long Beach City College in California, I took a personal and community health class, and I did a project with the American Cancer Society, and I fell in love with it. And I went on to get a degree in health education, and I worked as a health educator for Albuquerque Public Schools for a long time. And then I realized that I wanted to do something even beyond that, because health education is important, but population health and public health goes beyond that, with policy implications and a number of issues that have the potential to really improve health status in a big way. So I went on to get a master's in public health through the University of Arizona. I worked for a while with the Arizona Department of Health Services, and it's just something I'm really passionate about. I love it.
In your travels, in your studies, in your experience of doing this, what are some of the more dramatic changes that you've seen in people's health as a result of policy?
Well, you know, some of the biggest things that have happened nationwide are the mandating of seatbelts in cars and laws that require people to wear seatbelts. Even though we have many more cars on the road and we drive many more miles per year as a nation, traffic deaths have plummeted in the last couple of decades. So that's a policy issue that had far-reaching impact. And cars are much more safely built than they were 30, 40 years ago. You know, now you can buy a car with 15, 20 airbags in it.
What?
So there are all kinds of safety issues that make driving much safer than it was.
When you think about the old days of cars, they had steering wheels where the center of it was a point.
Yes.
And people didn't wear seatbelts, so they would, if they crashed into something, they would be literally impaled on their steering wheel and die.
Right. So cars are designed much more safely than they were. And most people now wear seatbelts every time they're in a car.
What is the relationship, and we've sort of touched on this, between economics, the economics of a state and the health of a state, not to mention the whole country? I mean, when we talk about the cost of diabetes, the cost of teenage pregnancy, the cost of drug addiction on this country, it has so many costs, and those costs go beyond the treatment of the illnesses.
Oh, they do. You know, you can measure the economic impact of all of these issues, like teen births and diabetes, but the human impact is more difficult to assess. You have years of lost life. You have other quality of life issues that are affected. So when we look at things that really affect health status, you know, the two biggest factors are education and income. Those are correlated very highly with health status. And that's why it's really exciting that this administration under Governor Martinez has focused tremendously on improving the economics and the education status of New Mexico, because those two things have a huge impact on overall health status.
When you think about the relationship between health and the ability to, I mean, even the ability to focus on getting your education, if you are eating junk food. I knew somebody who was kind of a visiting teacher in the Santa Fe Public Schools, and there was a kid who was considered a problem kid. And so they were basically shoved. He ended up, like, I think, tutoring this kid. He was one-on-one with the kid. And he said, "What did you have for breakfast?" And he said, "Well, I didn't have breakfast. I ate a Snickers bar." "Well, what did you eat for lunch?" "A Snickers bar and a Coke." And then he went to the principal and said, "This kid isn't a problem kid. This kid has no food. He's only eating sugar." So when you think about the impact of what can happen to that kid is already failing in school because of a poor diet. That kid might get fat. That kid might fail out of the system in all kinds of ways. Multiply that by whatever number, and you're talking about the New Mexico workforce.
Oh, you're absolutely right. So that's why I'm so excited about programs like Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities that recognize that access to high-quality food and physical activity is really important to the health of kids and their ability to do well in school.
How do you envision public health and the workforce that is necessary to have a strong public health system in New Mexico in the future?
Well, that's a good question, because we need to encourage more young people to go into this field. In fact, I'm speaking at a graduation next week of student nurses, and I'm going to be encouraging them to consider public health nursing, where they can have a big impact on population health status in New Mexico. So that's been a big emphasis in Governor Martinez's administration, is increasing the health care, the health system workforce in New Mexico. We now have a common curriculum for nursing students, so they can start anywhere in the state and transfer to any other institution in the state, because there's a common core curriculum. So lots of things are happening in New Mexico to encourage an increase in the healthcare workforce. We're working to encourage an increase in the public health workforce as well, because young people going into these fields is going to be critical, especially as our population ages.
Right, right. We're talking to Rheta Ward of the New Mexico Department of Health. What does a public health nurse do?
So it depends on where they are in the state. They do everything from counseling in terms of healthy behaviors, to they do immunizations. In Rio Ripa County, I went out with a public health nurse who was distributing naloxone. We have harm reduction programs for needle exchange in some of those areas as well. So it depends on the area, and it depends on the needs of the area. So we're involved a lot in prevention efforts, so nutrition efforts. We also have children's medical services, where we help with children that have very complex medical issues that need case management. So it just depends. We have many, many different areas where we work.
New Mexico has an accredited Department of Health. What does that mean? How did this happen?
So we just, in November of last year, received National Public Health Accreditation. It's a really big deal for us. We've been working on it for about 3 years. So it means that we have met a very rigorous set of national standards as a health department. And a lot of it has to do with continuous quality improvement, performance management. So we're one of only 12 state health departments in the country that's been accredited. So it was something we're very proud of, and we're hopeful that it will lead to increased funding opportunities as well.
What does that mean? Like, what kind of increased funding opportunities?
Well, you know, if you're in a competitive grant situation for federal funding or private funding, and you're one of the only states applying that has accreditation, it indicates that you're ready to take on this challenge and be successful at it.
How do you provide health care, and this is a subject that I know comes up over and over again, to rural places in New Mexico where there are not enough doctors, not enough nurses, not enough dentists, things like that?
Yeah, that's a challenge in a rural frontier state like New Mexico. So our 54 public health offices have traditionally helped with some of that, and we have a growing telehealth presence, not through the Department of Health, but through other entities in the state to help connect people in rural areas to health experts. Project Echo at UNM is providing a lot of training for providers in rural areas to give them expertise in treating complex issues like hepatitis C, chronic diabetes. So there are no easy solutions to this, but telehealth is one of the ways that will help provide access to rural areas. There are some programs that encourage providers to practice in these areas through loan forgiveness programs, repayment of loan programs, things like that.
One would think that repayment of loan programs would be very popular in these days of just excessive, crazy student loans.
And they are popular, yes.
Tell us a little bit more about telehealth. What does that mean? What does that term mean?
Well, there are different kinds of telehealth. Telehealth can be one patient being connected to a provider remotely for direct treatment of whatever health issue they deal with.
What do you mean, like through Skype? I mean,
yeah, through some technology like Skype, or it can mean one expert provider who is training other providers remotely in some rural areas, like teaching them how to treat hepatitis C, which is a very complex disease. So training them, and then they actually treat individually their patients. So there are multiple kinds of telehealth. It's not just a single thing.
What are its limitations? I mean, again, my grandmother was a physician, and she would look at the pallor of your skin. She would look at your eyes. She would look at the details that are not necessarily, you know, she would listen and feel things that aren't necessarily available through remote technology.
Right. And I'm not a telehealth expert, so I can't address that. But I do know that the technology is pretty sophisticated in terms of allowing for a one-on-one kind of consultation where the provider could actually look at the patient. So but I don't know the exact limitations.
What has been the impact of the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare, on public health in New Mexico?
So we have more people who are insured than we had a few years ago, which is a great thing, meaning that people are less likely to rely on emergency rooms for their health care needs. So we have more people on Medicaid because Governor Martinez chose to expand Medicaid in New Mexico. So we have fewer people who are uninsured in New Mexico, which means they have better access to health care.
Are there still quite a number of uninsured people?
There are some. I don't know the exact number, but there still are uninsured people, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so if somebody is uninsured, supposedly, I mean, under this, there were supposed to not be anybody uninsured, any citizens of this country, and you would even be penalized for being uninsured. How does that work? Do you know?
I don't know. That's part of the health insurance exchange that's outside the purview of my department, so I'm not exactly sure how that works.
You have worked not only in public health, but also in the private sector. How do you use your private sector experience in public health in government? Talk about that relationship.
Yeah, I worked in the private sector for 10 years. I worked for Hertz Rent-A-Car in Albuquerque and Chicago and New York. And that's really where I got my management and leadership training. They had really outstanding development of their managers. And so I learned how to run big organizations, how to get things done, how to be efficient, effective, how to evaluate performance. So it was very helpful, and I use those skills every day in the work that I do for the state.
So it's interesting. I mean, management and leadership doesn't even really matter what the topic is. Those are totally transferable skills.
Oh, absolutely. Very transferable skills. I used those when I was a teacher as well. So good management skills, good leadership skills are applicable in just about every venue of work.
What did you teach?
I taught health education. I taught biology, earth science, life science.
How did you decide to come back to public health after being in Hertz, in the rent-a-car business?
Well, because it was always a passion for me. And so I always incorporated a little bit of public health into all the work that I did, and now I'm officially doing it, and it's wonderful to do something that you're passionate about.
What do you say to the people, and you will inevitably come across them here and there, who don't want to vaccinate their children?
Well, you know, I'm a big proponent of vaccination because many of the strides that we've made in improving health status in the U.S. are the result of successful vaccination programs. You know, we no longer have to vaccinate children against smallpox because it's been eradicated from the earth. The only place the smallpox virus exists now is in labs. So that's one example of the success of that. And when I was growing up, I knew many people who had polio. And I remember when the polio vaccine became available and everybody in our town went to the school cafeteria and lined up to get the vaccine on a sugar cube. And basically, you know, once we had a large number of people vaccinated, the polio disease disappeared from the U.S. It's a very rare thing for anybody in the U.S. to get polio. So I would just tell parents that, you know, it's a great thing to protect our children. And I think there are a number of parents who probably are not old enough to have seen the effects of some of these devastating diseases that we've controlled with vaccines. I know there are people who are concerned about them, but they help save lives.
Yeah, and the people who do not vaccinate their children are basically taking advantage of the fact that everybody else does vaccinate their children and basically kind of form a safe, what would you call it, wall of health around their kids.
Right, so, you know, and it's not just important for children. We still have thousands of people who become very ill or hospitalized and die from influenza every year. And we could do a better job of increasing our adult influenza immunization rates to decrease death rates and serious illness rates in adults as well.
Do we have death from influenza here in New Mexico?
We do, yes. We've already had several deaths this year from influenza.
And what about plague?
We still have some cases of plague as well. There's not a vaccination for plague, but there is a treatment for plague. And if it's identified early, there is treatment for it.
Is there anything that you would like to leave us with? What do you think, what are the main things that our citizens of New Mexico should know about public health and about the New Mexico Health Department of Health?
Well, I think that we're working to improve the health status of every single person in New Mexico. And that's why we've identified the super priorities that we have to reduce the teen birth rate, to reduce substance misuse, type 2 diabetes rates, obesity rates, because if we can have a significant impact in those four areas, we'll have a huge impact in health status overall. I want us to be number one in the nation in health status, not number 37. And we're moving in the right direction, but I want us to accelerate that rate of improvement.
Retta Ward is Cabinet Secretary for the New Mexico Department of Health. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.